Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Dr. Robert Yondover. He is a scientist and an inventor. He's the CEO of Sea Rescue Corporation. He has a PhD in geochemistry and volcanology. He's worked in the labs of NASA, MIT, and more. He is a force of nature, and ironically, nature is where he likes to spend as much of his time as he can. This is a fantastic conversation where he not only demonstrates his passion and his energy for what he does, but dives pretty deep into his process for integrating creativity and science, two things that don't always go together. He's going to talk a lot about his problem-solving approach. And I think for all of us, no matter what we do professionally and often in life, problem-solving is what we do. So that was really a part of the conversation I was excited to dive into. He's going to talk about the importance of putting people's minds at ease when we're working with them. And he's even going to share the experience he had on Shark Tank. So this is a great conversation, tons of insight that I'm really excited to share with you all today. Thank you for being here for another conversation. While you're here, please take a quick second, like the show, share the show, subscribe to it. We really appreciate it. Thank you. And while you're online today, please take a moment to check out our sponsors. Please head over to humantel.com. That's where you can start the process of recognizing what people are likely thinking and feeling at any moment by identifying shifts in their emotions through their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. While you're there, enter the code INCLUSIVE25 for 25% off the best in-class online training of your choice. For the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn all you need to know about the International Association of Interviewers, what membership provides for you, and what you can provide for the organization. And that's also where you can learn all you need to know about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. Who qualifies? How do you earn it? What can it mean for your career moving forward and more? And while you're online, please check out inclusive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to custom facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, HR teams, and more to teach them how to apply the strategic observation and persuasive communication skills necessary to uncover hidden value in all of their high-impact conversations. We really appreciate you being here for another episode. Thank you so very much. So now, without further ado, we introduce to you Rob Yondover. Hello, Rob. It is great to meet you. How are you today?
Great. Thanks. I'm honored to be on here. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
I'm honored to have you on. I really am. I was doing my research, getting ready for the conversation, and just trying to wrap my brain around some of the things that you've invented and the process that goes into that. I'm fascinated. I can't wait to go home to tell my son I spoke to a real inventor. He's going to be impressed just by that alone. So
thank you.
I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
Well, I like to tell people I'm a scientist first, and I'm a scientist inventor, because if you just say inventor, they think you're a crazy man in a garage, which I am. I'm that too. But I got my PhD working on volcanoes. I worked on submarine volcanoes off Galapagos, got to go down on an Alvin submersible 2 miles down. And my whole family, we're just kind of weird. We're kind of artsy, creative, yet I overprinted that with science. And so I have this technical background, but maybe a childlike creative eye. And I was just brought up always trying to rig things. And in our house, we had a couple of big mantras. One was just say no to a real job. You know, that was bad. If you got a real job, you're like a failure in my family.
That's awesome.
Another was never buy anything new, right? So that was big arguments with my parents. But my father and now me, I see the pride I get from fixing something or creating something out of other things. My father was a depression guy, World War II. So it really hit home. We didn't have that much money, but he took great pride in solving a problem, even if it looked horrible. And I still believe that. And it's function over form, right? Most people are form over function, make it look pretty. Right. I'm the opposite. If it works and you did it without having to even go to a store, you just got materials from your garage, you know, ideally, that's the best way. If you go to the store and you buy something, break it apart to use one piece of it and make something out of that, that's the next level. So, you know, and I'm just exposed to a lot of arts and crafts as a kid and travel. And I just, you know, I like meeting new people, new perspectives, and new way to solve problems. And, you know, I've been in Hawaii now 40 years. I'm a surfer. So it was the obvious place after growing up in Miami. And it's the same thing here. The Polynesians invented all these great things. You don't hear about them, but in the ocean world, survival world, they were dealing with minimal materials, but having maximum challenges, and they handled it. So I try to keep going that way myself, and when work with what I have at hand. And it's been pretty good. But I mean, of course, it doesn't always sit well. My late wife used to say, stop playing with that piece of plastic and get a real job. You know, so she didn't quite get it, but she got it later.
But my mantra is, don't get a real job. I'm conflicted here.
Exactly. And
make my wife happy, live my family motto. What do I do?
Exactly. I had a PhD, so she assumed I had a PhD in science. I should be making tons of money. But she didn't realize that lifestyle is more important than money. And I knew that early on from my family. My father, you know, I wrote a book called Hardcore Inventing, and the working title was Inventing in Your Underwear, as an homage to my father, who never used to wear clothes. You know, you wear underwear. My friends would be coming around because he worked out of his home. He had a phone in his bathroom. He was the original mail order guy. So he was totally virtual 70 years ago. Wow. And it was, you know, it just was such a example. But if he wanted to go with us and hang out with us or take us fishing on a Tuesday afternoon, he could. So that flexibility is key. And, you know, we didn't have a lot of great things, but we had him and my mom. We had a family, and we had, the beauty of time and freedom. I mean, that's worth more than money. I mean, that's the thing.
It certainly is. And even with that intro, which was fantastic, we had a couple of ways to go right out of the gate. So you talk about having the creative eye, but also being a scientist.
Right.
In looking from the outside in, I'm sure there's plenty of creativity in science, but intuitively, it doesn't feel that way. Science feels more, when I say rigged, I don't mean like fixed or fake, but like there's a process that's rigged, that's step one, right. Step two, step three, where creativity is, well, let's figure it out. I think this might happen.
Exactly.
Oh, damn, that happened. Well, look what we got now.
Exactly.
So from your perspective, how did you learn to balance the creativity with the structure of science?
Well, it's very frustrating. You're absolutely right, because science is a lot of rigor and repeating experiments to make a little tiny contribution. That's one of the reasons I got out of academia. It wasn't free form enough for me. But you know, the way to look at problems and attack problems, I love. I love saying, okay, here's a problem. I want to prove this solution, but you have to prove it technically and rigorously before you actually can say it's proven. And there's a couple things I do, like a macro micro approach. So you look at problems widely and look at all the types of solutions, and then you focus down and then you attack it. And then as you're attacking a problem, you might get frustrated. You leave it up for a while. One of the things I've done effectively is leave a problem, go to another problem, come back, and then there that problem is, but you have a new set of eyes. And the other thing is, I was very influenced by Thoreau and Emerson, the nature guys. And I'm a nature boy. So I'm very much into biomimicry. I don't know if you know about that. So you mimic biology. Even my invention of the streamer is basically, the big breakthrough was struts, spreader bars in this long piece of plastic that keeps it from twisting up, like a centipede, like your vertebrae. Segmentation leads to strength. So we have billions of years of evolution, and we're just a bunch of dumb human animal monkeys that are just here lately. Why not look at this body of work that nature's done and evolution has done? And that's been helping me forever. And when I go out as a surfer or paddler, I go out into nature, it kind of cleanses me and gets me thinking cleanly. And then it's just kind of like random thoughts. You don't really want to focus on something, because it's sometimes that's how something pops in your mind when you're not thinking of it. So that's been another way. And I just keep, it's very fruitful to come up with your own stuff. And even academia was tough, because you couldn't, and I kind of did. My PhD was a little bit out there, because I was working on lasers at MIT and NASA, looking at lava samples and blowing them up in a laser and analyzing the gas or trace elements. And no one really cared, and no one thought it was valuable, but the MIT guy did. And he became the big mentor in that. And he kind of blew me off, which was a good lesson for me, because sometimes the best lessons are when it's a negative outcome. But that said to me, I don't want to be in academia. I'm not going to get credit. And it's just a little notch of knowledge that may or may not be useful. I want to work on applied science. So to be an inventor, I want to solve problems. And I've solved hundreds of problems. A lot of them are a joke, and I wouldn't, you know, they never make it. The key is picking the right one. You know, I used to get things burned off my back by the dermatologist, so I started using a little paint roller to roll sunscreen on my back. People used to laugh at me, but it worked. You know, little stuff like that. You know, I have a million inventions, but they don't all see the light of day because you have to be selective, just like you do in any conversation. You have to select your words, you know, carefully, and you have to read. The other thing that I've learned, as you spoke about scientists, and they aren't really creative, and they're not really easy to talk to. And one of the things I pride myself on is I think I'm like a translator. I can make complex things sound simple. I do a lot of education outreach because I love turning kids on to complicated things and making them realize it's really quite simple if you look at it and have it broken down and translated to you. So I try to do as much of that as I can, even to myself. And even when my early days in college, the professors kind of thought I was dumb because I would ask stupid questions. I wasn't afraid to because I didn't understand it. And you show it to me so I can understand it in a way I can understand. So there was a lot of that going on, and you just have to be perseverant. And, you know, that's been really the key to my whole success was never quitting. I could have quit 100 times over. So, you know, got to keep going.
I've stolen that line a few times. People say, well, you're doing a great job. No, I'm just too dumb to quit.
Exactly.
I've come this far. I don't know how far I passed the Rubicon, but I can't turn around now. I'm kind of stuck.
Got the momentum.
I love how you said, show it to me so I can understand. I mean, that right there, if you think about communicating through any problem-solving process or just helping teach somebody, show it to them so they can understand. I think that right there is maybe simple is the wrong word, but a clear, concise line of brilliance. I would love to get back in just a minute to making the complex simple. I'm fascinated by that. But before we do that, I want to circle back to problem solving. People might roll their eyes every time I mention my son, but I feel like every conversation I have makes me think about not just being better at my job, but being better at my most important job at home as well. So as I'm raising a young guy who's in elementary school at the moment, I love it when he says it back to me, but I try to talk to him about think like a problem solver. So even for me, coming from investigations, like an investigator is a problem solver. I got a series of problems I got to solve to get to the truth. So sometimes I'll pick him up at school, you know, and I'll ask him, what was the best part of your day? He's like, well, Dad, I thought like a problem solver. Like, okay, I can go to sleep now. But for you attack problems at a level that I certainly never have and at a depth that I haven't in different types of problems. So when you think about breaking down the problems, let me do it this way. I'm so excited I'm talking in circles. I'd like to approach this two ways. Breaking down the problem-solving process and then communicating through the problem-solving process. How do you do that?
That's a good one. First of all, I got a couple of kids, and I think kids are the best inventors. They're the most creative, and only us adults get screwed by learning too much in a way. And I'll give you one little anecdote. My son was a little kid. He took him to an Italian restaurant. He was probably as old as your son. And he's eating garlic bread. He's holding it under his nose while he's eating pasta. I go, what are you doing? He goes, I hate the smell of the spaghetti, but I like the smell of the garlic bread. So he shoved it up under, you know, so I knew he was kind of an inventor.
That's awesome.
So yeah, the breaking the problem down. I mean, I just kind of, you look for pain areas. You know, first of all, I like to invent stuff that bothers me. So when I'm like, I fish rough water and I'm surfing, it seems like I'm on a plane, a lot of planes. I always feel like I'm on the edge of dying, live volcanoes, things like that. So I like to think about contingencies. And I read a lot about survival stories of people doing things with very minimal tools. So I put my brain to work and say, okay, what if this break? What if the motors break and the boat sinking? What am I going to do? So I always like to pose the problem to me and then try to come up with a solution. And then if I come up with a solution, I have to say, would I want one of those? Right? That's kind of the 1-2 punch. And that's just me. But to get it to a larger audience, would people want this? And, you know, that is the bigger question. But still, there's such gratification in just saying, I solved the problem that was a problem for me. Right. And then also observe. I mean, being observant and curious are the most important. So I'm observing people having problems with this. And I've always thought I've got a big brain. Okay, it's pretty good. I got a PhD. Why not attack big problems? Like the the sunscreen on the back, that's not a big problem. I've got, when I was five, I invented the little motors that spun. I put a straw in it, it spun, and I shoved it up my nose when I was five. That was the electric nose picker. So that was a good problem to solve, but that wasn't going to really save lives. So later in life, I'm like, the home run is to solve a problem that's critical, that could save someone's life or change the world. So that's kind of where I try to focus, because I like to go for the home run. You know, you talked to baseball earlier. Single or double is good too, but if you go for the home run, you're going all the way. Just like you're saying, you're moving so fast, you're not going to back off now. You've got all this momentum. You go, and then when you start doing it, the key to a problem is being able to explain it. And my brother, who was a big marketing advertising guy, told me, he helped me name my company, because Sea Rescue Streamer was Sea Locator. I had it right, S-E-E Locator, but he came up with the /rescue and the tagline, you have to be seen to be rescued. He said, everyone's selling a product and how great the little characteristics are, but you got to sell the benefit. This thing will save your ass, okay? That's the benefit. It'll save your life. If that isn't important to you, then I don't know what to do. But I'm trying to invent something and then sell the benefit to you. And you have to do that in communicating with people, whether I know them or not, even like in a trade show. You have literally seconds to do that. You know, and I don't know if some of your audience is in that sales world, but one of the things I came up with as of now, I'm a veteran trade show guy, for better or worse. I like to say I hate trade shows, but I love trade shows. Because that was the first time, if you put a suit and tie on or whatever the attire is, and you shave and you get in there, you're on even keel with big, powerful people in your industry. And you can walk the floor. And I just walk the floor and meet people and try to poach people from other booths. And you have to read name tags upside down, all that. But what I realized when I finally got my booth is, how do you get people that are walking by? How do you engage them? And it's kind of what you're talking about. How do you explain the problem? So the first thing is, I wouldn't say hello. I tried everything. Hey, how are you doing? Fine. I keep walking. And the thing is, can I help you? Okay. No, people don't want to be helped. But the four words I use that always work, I still use it to this day, is, have you seen this? If they say yes, you say, well, you haven't seen the lighted version for fighter pilots. If they say no, you got them either way. You're asking them a question. You're engaging with them. And the other thing is, to me, I was brought up old school. You look people in the eyes, handshake. That's so lost today. And it's kind of a bummer. And I feel bad for your kids. And my kids are a little much older than yours, but I got a grandkid too. It's the same thing. How are they going to get over this addiction to smartphones, which is horrible, and this lack of interpersonal skills? And it's so critical forever is how you deal with people. And the people that are coming up today have no social skills, and you know, whether it's for sales or not, just in general. So I felt that was really one of my special skills, was I could translate on the fly and make people understand what I'm talking about and relate to them and size them up. What who is this person? What are they about? What industry, what world are they coming from? Are they tracking with me? Are their eyes glazing over and going to sleep, or are they excited? If I go this way, are they less interested than I go that way? So it's kind of a dance, and I really enjoy that. And I think it's something, it's kind of a lost art. And I really, when I come across a kid that looks me in the eye and engages with a question and listens to my answer and then asks me a question, I'm very impressed, because we had it easier, because that's how it was before phones. Now, if someone's like that, despite phones, I'm really impressed. I don't know if I answered your question, but I went around it.
No, you did. You did. Okay. We talk about breaking down the problem, being able to explain it. Sometimes when I'm working specifically with groups on problem solving, we'll go through, like, often for me, the first thing I'll ask somebody, different context a little bit, but instead of asking them what's the problem, I'll ask them, what's your goal? Because the right answer to the wrong question is still the wrong answer. So let's make sure that we get the goal straight. Okay, well, if that's the goal, now what's the problem we're looking to solve? Because maybe the problem is different now.
Exactly.
Then okay, what have you already tried? Because there's a chance that they actually were real close and just they weren't looking at the right way. We can get them there. Okay, if those aren't good, what should we do next?
Right.
We go through all that. And then it's, what do you think is the best choice, but why? And I think that gets back to your ability to explain the problem, because right. if we separate the process from the results, you might have got lucky and landed mm-hmm. on the right answer, but have mm-hmm. no idea why it's the right answer.
Right.
Or you might have the thought process dead on, but mm-hmm. at the last second ended up at the wrong answer. So if I can separate the process from the results, then we can really work this through. So I feel like you nailed it. I mean, here, I'm telling you, I feel like you nailed it. You're the one with the PhD with all the inventions. But if people can explain the problem, then right. to the understanding of it, the ability to communicate it to others, to work together to find the solutions. No, right. I think that was a spectacular answer.
Thanks.
Which circles back to making complex simple. How do you do that?
Well, again, for me, I have to understand it first. So like I said earlier, I can sound like an idiot because I'm not afraid to ask the dumb question and dwell on it. And there's something a little tweaked about my mind where certain things I have problems with, and a lot of people get it easily. And it's just the way it is with my brain. But once I get it, I get it. So I have to go through the pain and the time and effort it takes for me to understand something. Then I can share it. Because if I don't understand it, then how do I share it? And that's, you have to get over that and get over the fear of not understanding it or glossing over. Yeah, I understand. Just keep moving on. By the way, you're very analytical the way you talk. And I mean, you're good. You could be a scientist if you're not already one in your field. But I just think that that's a key thing, is getting into that mode where your mind has to understand it. You have to convince yourself it's a good idea. And, you know, I was doing crowdsourcing before it was called crowdsourcing. So I have this wacky idea, this streamer idea. I ask people about it. And I grade their opinion. You know, some opinions mean more than others, mm-hmm. but statistically, a lot of them mean something. Even when I buy something online, I'll read 100 reviews of something just for that one little nugget that someone says, oh, but that, or oh, that. So it's all a bunch of data. And when you're developing a product, it's similar, because you're trying to solve a problem. But to stay in business, you have to solve a problem that people want and are willing to buy. I personally happen to pick the wrong industry. I mean, it's fine for me. But in terms of sales, selling safety is the hardest thing in the world, because people don't want to think about it. And that's where I ended up mainly in the military, because the military does think about it. They've got it. They're invested in their fighter pilots or their boat crew. They don't want to get them lost at sea or lost in the mountains. So they have a kind of an obligation to be as safe as possible. But Joe Boner and Joanne Hiker, they don't necessarily care as much. So I keep analyzing this, and this has been going on for 20, 30 years, trying to sell it. And I've done the maximum. I got it on Shark Tank. 9 million people saw it one night. And it still is hard to sell. I mean, we make sales, of course. But the other thing I realize is men and women are different, you know, and women think differently. And to me, women are smarter. No offense to our brethren, but women are smarter and more careful and more logical when they think about long-term things like, oh, I'm going out fishing in a little boat on a rough day. Well, what kind of safety stuff do you have? They're more likely to see that. Macho guys will say, we have enough beer or bait, you know, or food.
In that order.
Exactly.
Beer, then bait.
So it's been an interesting road, but all the things we've talked about, it's even more pronounced in this safety world because it's harder to sell. You're selling something to people that don't really know they want it, or when they know about it, they don't really want it because they don't want to think about it. So yeah. It's almost like selling insurance, which is hard too. It's similar. Like selling life insurance.
Yeah. And that's a good point too, for people who, like, you almost have to embrace the worst case. And
right.
honestly, to some degree, we all should be doing that anyway. I mean, we shouldn't be, you know, crazy off the deep end, but at least be situationally aware of what we're potentially getting into and right. what are reasonable steps we can take in order to help us should things start to break bad.
Exactly.
That's true if you're on a boat, it's true if you're in a plane, it's true if you're in a boardroom full of people. I mean, that exactly. type of thought process is going to be healthy. You talk about understanding it first. And I won't right. bore people with my examples, but I can think of times where I've been asked to teach. And I mm-hmm. think, okay, I'll teach this idea, this concept, this move, this thing. And sure. I'm like, well, wait a minute. I do it, but I'm not sure I understand it well enough to teach somebody else how to do it.
Right.
It almost feels natural to me. So I got to find something else to teach. So when you think about teaching something that you have brought yourself to an understanding of, but you have to teach it to somebody else, maybe even not a customer, but during the invention process or bringing it from, you know, idea to product, somewhere in that range.
Sure.
How have you learned to develop the skill to help somebody else understand when they're struggling to bring on board something that you already understand?
Well, I tell you how I've done it, and I've done it with the streamer, is visually. I think people are visual learners or tactile learners. So what I used to do is walk around trade shows before I even had a booth, and I had a before and after picture. Before, this is what you look like without a streamer when you're lost at sea. You can't see. Your head's a speck. It's just blue water. Here's you with it. There's an orange stripe in the water. That's how I lead all my talks, with those two slides, because that is a visceral way for people to understand before and after. This is what you look like with and without it. And that's been very, very useful for me, because the other thing is I try to be casual about how I speak and not kind of over technical them, especially non-technical people. Just basic stuff. This is you without, this is with you with it. Which would you prefer? Oh, if you don't want, it's almost, one thing I think is that if you're laughing, you're learning. So I like to crack jokes sometimes. But like some of the people I say, look, this is how your loved ones will look fishing if the boat sinks. Now, here's how they look if the boat sinks with a streamer. Now, if you want them to come back, you should buy a streamer. If you don't buy it for them. You know, if you don't like your husband or wife, you know, so just kind of keep it light. But I feel like people are more receptive when they're less tense. And I know my voice is real deep. So for years, I would talk to people on the phone only in the early days before, you know, podcasting and Zooms. And that it was like when they met me, they were so relieved that I was like, and this is when I was younger looking. They thought, oh, you sound like an old man. You know, they thought I was going to look like Colonel Sanders. You know, I'm getting there now. But, you know, it's so in person, there's mannerisms, body language that you can do to put people at ease. Yet on the flip side is, how do you dress and appear to get respect? So that, you know, there's a fine line there. And as casual as I am, I'm very analytical on how I dress on every situation and how I appear. And it's always, people always give me grief for it, but I'm like, no, this is important. How I look is important, because if you look too stuffed up, people aren't going to be able to approach you, you know, or want you to approach them. Or if you're too casual, you're not taking it seriously. So there's somewhere in between. And it's the same with the language. Your language has to match the person you're talking to, or maybe be a slightly below or close. So they, you know, they're put at ease, or you get respect from them. It all depends on what the situation is. And that's why for me, in person's the best, video calls second, third is phone, way distant is emails or text, because it's a one-way conversation without eye contact. So it's really fascinating how people, and we all have to do it now because everything is virtual. At least we have this Zooming, but you know, have you tried to call people on a phone lately? People don't talk on the phone. It's so, I feel bad now almost calling people. It's like you're interrupting them from scrolling or whatever they're doing. It's just,
yeah. Interrupting them from wasting their time. Waste your time with me. You're not doing anything.
Exactly. So it's a challenge, especially, you know, I've seen all the different generations that I've lived through, and it's just fascinating to me. You know, like the old, you know, even like for dress for success, what I was just talking about, my mantra is overdress for success. So I don't mind being a suit and tie if everyone's wearing just collar shirts, but it depends on the situation. But when in doubt, I'd rather overdress, because you always peel clothes off, right?
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of things like that.
Yeah, I have to give my wife tons of credit there. So two things. It's funny hearing you talk about, you know, matching the right language and matching the right dress and matching the right body language and all of those things. That's all stuff that I was taught in investigations. Like, depending on who you're talking to and what the case is about and the truth that you need, the color shirt I wear that day, whether I wear a tie, a coat, jeans, slacks, all long sleeve, short sleeve, all of those things can make which watch do I wear? I don't have expensive watches. Some of them look shinier than others.
Right.
All of these things can make a difference. I don't want to talk over someone's head because right. I could lose credibility and they could feel stupid. But I also don't want to talk like I'm just stumbling out of the pub because now I'm going to lose all my credibility too. So finding those right things. But I also have to give my wife tons of credit because she has straightened me out in any number of ways that we probably don't have time to talk about. But dressing is one because, right. you know, for me, you talked about being pretty casual. For me, like, yeah, I mean, my casual might be an exaggerated way to talk about how I would prefer to dress, but her helping me realize, you know, be in these rooms with these people for them, like you're saying, like, right. take you seriously. The way I tried to rationalize it is life is a costume party. So depending exactly. on what I'm trying to get out of, what relationship, what room, like I'm the same person, but I got to be wearing the right costume.
Absolutely. Some people have never seen me with a shirt on and some people have never seen me without a coat and tie on. And that's the truth. So it's like, yeah. which costume party am I at? And you know, it's the comfort level, but it's comfort with them. You have to put people at ease so their minds are open. Because if you're not at ease, you've got guards up and you don't let things in. Even for inventing and problem solving, I want to be relaxed when I think of stuff. And this whole thing of putting pressure on to solve problems, the other thing I like to say is never quit your day job so you can quit your day job. And to be an inventor and problem solver, you don't want to have the stress. It may happen in day two or year three when your big inspiration comes in. And even then, it may take 4 years to build it. So you don't need the pressure of money and paying the bills. You should do it always on the side. And, you know, if you do the math, there are 120 hours in the week, 40 hours to sleep, 40 hours to work. That still leaves you 40. So you can work days and weekends without any pressure because most businesses don't work. Most inventors aren't successful, but every inventor is successful if they figure out something because that yeah. is gratifying, right? I solved this problem, whether it's, you know, a social problem, a hands-on problem, an object, a process, whatever you invent. And like I said, we're all inventors and we got to invent the way to survive every day. So it's an interesting business to be in, to say the least.
I can only imagine. So talking about interesting businesses, and I can only imagine, you just casually dropped earlier that 9 million people saw you on TV in one night because you were on Shark Tank. So for those of us that see it from the couch or the airplane sure. or wherever we watch it from, I'm sure we're looking at a finished product and things are cut and things are kind of clipped together and whatnot. But from what was it like for you?
Sure.
Earlier, you talk about having to make the quick connection and influence people and sure. get their attention. And I imagine that that is more true than ever in that right. type of environment. So what was that experience like for you standing in front of that group of investors
right.
trying to get buy-in?
Absolutely a trip and a rush because I knew them. They didn't know me at all. It's real. There's no script in anything. And I was in there like an hour and you watch the show, it's on for 7 minutes.
Yeah.
So it was unbelievable. And you know, like when you size people up, they have a part where they want you to walk in and hesitate and look at each shark so they can record your facial reaction. And that was the hardest part for me because I'm like, I'm ready. I'm ready to go. And you're making me wait. And I'm looking at Mark Cuban. He's looking at me. And I'm like, you know, I revert to my old basketball days. Like, I'm going to kick your ass. You know, I was all getting revved up. And I knew what I wanted to say. But it was really, it's the same thing I've been just talking about. But you have to get over the fact that these are famous, powerful people. You know, 9 million people are going to watch it. There are 100 cameras. It's a massive amount of pressure. And I went out there alone. So it wasn't like I had some partner to say, hey, you know, you pick it up. I'm stuttering here. There was none of that. And I was just, you know, as soon as I spit out the first couple things, and the truth is I had some strategies. I don't go into anything casually. I may look casual, but I showed that before and after picture, and I knew that was going to be the clicker, because if before and after, and Damon fell right into it. He goes, I don't understand it. I can't see the guy. I said, yeah, that's the whole point. So it put me at ease. And I also, the thing I tell about anyone presenting anything to anyone is, you know the most about your product. So I kept, and I've given talks forever in the academia world, in the science world, in my business world. So I'm a confident speaker. And that, as soon as I realized, and I don't want to put them down, but they're not that smart. You know, Mark Cuban's smart, but the others, they're tracking with me, but they're not really getting the whole thing. And I'm like, oh, okay. This is like giving a talk at a college. I won't say a high school, but you know, they're smart enough. And Mark Cuban was just, he wouldn't leave me alone about my volcano background. He was fascinated because I think he's bored out of his mind, you know, looking at people selling cupcakes and stuff. So at one point, Mr. Wonderful said, stop talking to him about volcanoes. Let's talk about the streamer. He goes, I can talk to this guy all day. So it was just, and I just kind of tried to play casual. And even when they were going out, they all liked it on national TV, which was great. But I was pissed they weren't going to invest. I thought there'd be a bidding war because I thought that they would want to save lives. And I saved some lives already. I've had people thank me because the streamer saved them in the water and on some military guys in the mountains. There's many more people we don't know about, but the ones I've met, and I'm like trying to share with them how that felt to be thanked for saving a life. And that didn't even register. And I'm like, I couldn't believe it. They were caring about how much money can we make. And I'm like,
yeah,
then I kind of lost respect to them a little. Like I said, I made this special, you know, like a great offer. Cause I just wanted to like have a bidding war and end up with the best partner. But now a few years later, I'm like, I'm happy I don't have a partner because they would have pushed me in a direction. Like they might have said, you need to go to all these trade shows. You need to move your production from Hawaii to, let's say, China, which would have been a mistake, especially in today's present day.
Yeah.
With the tariffs and just things like that. So I was really, you know, as a competitor, I was pissed off when they started all going out. But I'm like, okay, keep your composure. That's okay. And even afterward, the producer said, God, you did great. I'm like, really? They all went out. She was like, it doesn't matter. You did great. And so it was a trip. It was a surreal experience. And, you know, I've had a lot of experience speaking and defending myself and knowing about my technology. So I felt confident about that. And I had the answers to their questions. And but the real thing is that I went for it. I know the proudest thing. I talk to people all the time. Oh, what are you doing now? You're never going to. That's not going to do anything. But that's what people have been telling me my whole life. It's like, okay, you got a dream, you got to go for it. And you can't be afraid to get shot down. Yeah, I got shot down on national TV. I don't care. They've shown it 100 times now on CNBC. Every time they show it, my Amazon sales tick up. So it's still working for me.
Yeah.
The only bummer is I was in the hair and makeup trailer and I looked better, you know, and that was like 5 years ago. So I'm aging. But it doesn't matter. It was really a cool experience. And, you know, but they say it's 1 in 40,000 applicants get in.
Oh,
the,
wow.
The chances of getting that are really difficult. And I didn't know anyone. I went to the Alawana Hotel, had a camel fall here. And I got up at 5 a.m. because I wanted to be early in line and not in the sun. And, you know, I pitched, you know, that's when you got to keep doing it. And even the streamer, I built the streamer through the media. And getting free PR. My brother, the advertising guy, said there's editors sitting on their ass every day wondering what to write about. So in the old days, the faxing at 11:01, it was cheaper to send a fax in Hawaii. So I would wait at 11 o'clock and I'd send 100 faxes. It's like fishing. Put 100 lines out, you get a bite, catch a fish. If it's a good fish, you show that fish 100 times. I keep doing that for 20 years. I've got CNN, Discovery Channel, Shark Tank, Innovation Nation. I've been in every magazine you can find. And the other thing that I'm pretty good at is not dominating. I may be dominating this conversation, but not dominating people's creativity. So I get to a writer or an editor, and I don't tell them what to do or say. I want them to say their experience, their perspective. So, for instance, Men's Journal wrote about the streamer, and they said their tagline was, Gilligan's Island would have been one episode if they had the streamer. That was awesome. See, I didn't think of that, but that's where you let other people run with things and they respect you for doing that. And they kind of want to do a good job just to show their good stuff. So that's been useful for me forever. And it's just kind of just human nature. I don't want to dominate people. I want to work with people. And that's kind of an attitude I have. And that's where even that shark thing, it's kind of a misnomer because you're not going to, me and Mark Cuban aren't going to roll up our sleeves and work on the Sea Rescue streamer every night. You know, there's going to be some 30-year-old assistant that works for him that's going to be like my boss. And so, you know, so it was a great experience, but it was a risk. And my brother, who again, one of my advisors, said, "You're crazy. You shouldn't do this." I'm like, "Well, I don't care. I'm going for it because they can make you look like an idiot." I go, "Oh, whatever. I mean, I'm okay with that. I'm willing to take the risk." You know, a lot of people are afraid to take that leap and try something.
Sure.
And that's also back to the don't quit your day job. If you're really afraid to start a new business or a new invention, start it on the side. So there's no consequence to it going slowly or you failing and walking away or pivoting and starting something new. There's no consequence on your financial situation, your family situation. You just try it in your spare time. And if you solve anything or achieve anything, that's just personally grateful anyway, whether it has any monetary success or not.
And then you can build off of that.
Right.
It's, I mean, I've personality-wise, I feel like we might be a little bit similar. Somebody tells me, you know, "You're crazy." I'm like, "That's not new news."
Like, exactly. No, that's incentive for me. Yes. You know, if they say you can't do something, I really want to do it.
Yeah, now we're on fire.
Right. Well, it's a challenge, and I like to go for it. So.
You said something earlier that really struck me. I feel like in a lot of the interactions, and I can only speak for like what I feel like I've seen or I've experienced, but if I find myself in a scenario where I'm dealing with somebody who either, and they could very well be the expert, but they feel like they're the expert. Mm-hmm. They've got the history, the degree, the experience, the expertise, whatever it is.
Right.
A lot of times they do. Sometimes they feel like they do. But to run into people who feel like they are smart in an area.
Right.
I watch a lot of people struggle to keep that in their back pocket when they're talking to somebody about similar topics, similar themes, similar. So you're obviously a very creative person. Right. And you just said that you don't like dominating somebody else's creativity. So if you're working right. with a writer, a producer, an interviewer, or somebody, like you want them to have their level of creativity. I feel like that's not common. Like if somebody's a creative person and right. they're working with somebody else, well, let me tell you how I like to be creative because this is my brand, my product, my story. This is how we're going to do it. Where did you learn to have, whether it's the confidence, the patience, the humility, wherever it is, to step back
right.
and let other people take the creative control or license in the conversation where that's so much of what you do?
That's thank you. Well, a lot of it is I respect people and I respect my elders. So I grew up always admiring older people. In my house, we didn't have a TV in the living room. There was just a room full of chairs and couches. And the older people, when I was like 5 or 10 years old, they're always in there talking, laughing. I'm like, I want to get into that table. So I just want to listen. But every time I get close, they would stop talking. And that's why now when I got older and I finally got to that table, and people were talking about stupid shit like the weather. I'm like, Jesus, we got bigger things to talk about. So I admire people that are talking, that are creative, that are accomplished. And I also had a little mantra on my fridge in college that says, "Those who can do, those who can't talk." And it's just true. And you know, just like your forensic work, people tell you who they are. So I want to listen to you. And if you're telling me something and you're like, "I'm an idiot," okay, keep talking. But you're telling me who you are. Or if you're telling me you're brilliant, I want to learn more. I don't want to interrupt this. I want to learn from everyone so people can teach me. And that's where I try to learn from people and learn from situations. And, you know, it's hard because I talk a lot of smack and I talk a lot. So it's hard to just be quiet. But I feel like if I'm with people that are talented, I want to hear what they have to say. And even if they're not, they're telling me something. And it's like, I don't want to talk myself out if they're not even going to be listening. So I think it's important to do that. And it is hard. But I like to do it because it's also some of the best things that are done in the world are come from collaborations, right? I mean, you can't do everything yourself. And, you know, in the patent world, it's a little risky because I try to invent alone, but do business together. Because inventing, if you and I are talking about an invention and you say one thing while I say another, we're co-inventors from cradle to grave of that invention. And that's troubling to me because it's too complicated to have two inventors because then you're married and it's not the good kind of married. So it's potentially dangerous. So I like to come up with my own inventions, patent them, protect them. And then when I have them protected as a baseline, then I work with people. Then I have them come in. And also like with the Air Force, the fighter pilot version, they wanted it to pump out automatically when a pilot ejects, because it's such a violent act. And I came up with this water-soluble pouch based on that candy, rice paper candy that dissolves in your mouth, or the dishwasher things. You put them in a dishwasher, on a little pouch. Yeah, I found
that little kid should not think are candy.
Exactly. So that material I found like 20 years ago. I go, this is perfect. I'll put a streamer in that. I'll Z-fold it instead of roll it up, and it'll just drift out. But okay, so I got the patent and all that. But then when we got a contract with the Air Force, a couple of these Air Force engineers said, oh, we don't want to do a whole pouch of that stuff. Let's just make a pouch and tie it. We made string out of that stuff. That was brilliant. And because I didn't dominate those meetings, I let them come up with stuff and collaborate. And again, everyone wants to contribute. And then when you're in a collaborative environment, people want to listen, people want to contribute, and you're less likely to be talking bullshit if you know people around you are smart and creative and can contribute. And time is money. You can't take too much of everyone's time. You don't get to have their input. And input is valuable. Input can be negative, neutral, or positive, but whatever it is, it's input. So I like to listen, and I've gotten fairly good at it. I mean, it's hard to shut up for me, but when it's important, I can.
Well, it ties back to being observant and curious, which you mentioned 35 minutes ago when we started this conversation.
And then thinking way, way back, I didn't talk that much as a kid. My brother and I had a secret language, and my parents thought I was tweaked. And I mean, I was and I am, but maybe that is part of it. And I was really, really shy. My parents, one of the worst things they ever did to me, which I took as fuel, was I was maybe 12 or 13. And they said, what do you want to do when you grow up? I said, I want to go into PR, public relations. And they laughed at me. Because they knew how shy I was. I couldn't speak so well. And it's like, okay. But that drove me to get better at it. You know, and even another example is reading. I didn't read a lot of books because I'm like an adventure action guy on the streets and in the water all the time. But I took a freshman English class, literature check, and they made us read like all the classics. I'm like, Jesus, those books are incredible. They lasted 100 years. They're incredible. Hemingway, Scarlet Letter, all these great books. And my brother, who's like a bookworm, he used to read 3 books a week. I'm like, I'm never going to do that. I don't have enough time. But what I'm going to do, and I still do it to this day, is I keep reading classics. So I've caught up in reading literature and writing that I've forced myself to be a better enunciator when I speak and understand things better and see different perspectives. One of the other things I love is foreign movies. If it doesn't have subtitles, I'm not even interested in the movie, because I want to learn from other cultures, how they interact. So it's all just kind of a learning thing and meeting as many humans with as many opinions as you can, especially if they have valid opinions.
Yeah, and I have to guess that learning mentality, that observant curiosity mentality, is what in a lot of ways drives the invention and the problem solving process. If I'm constantly seeking something new and different, then a wire will trip. And maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow. I think you used the word insight earlier. I was thinking about one thing, but then I was reminded about something that felt completely unrelated at the time. But exactly. Here we are, we're working on something new together. And I feel like trying to teach people the value, and I'm not saying I do it on your level, please don't take it that way at all.
Okay.
But trying to teach people the value of giving yourself a reason, like I'm hanging in this conversation, I'm hanging in this process, I'm reading this book, I'm watching this movie, whatever it is, because there could be something out there that leads me to a place I never thought I could get to.
Exactly. I'm
trying to teach people to think that way.
A lot of it's subconscious. And I really do think that, and I notice this with my brain, if you can't think of something, you know, that tip of the tongue type of thing, I've learned that if you change the subject, then you think of it. So it's the same thing. If you're free and relaxing, and let's say I'm surfing or paddling or watching a movie, my mind is so calm. It's engaged, but the backside, where I'm usually creative or analyzing or worrying about my daily work schedule, whatever it is, that's all calm because I'm focused. But because that's calm, sometimes things spring up related to that. It's weird. It's like it's a creative calm that I have. And I like to try to get there. And it doesn't, you never know when it hits. And I used to wander around Home Depots looking at materials going, how am I going to solve this? I can take that thing and break it apart and use that thing. And the other thing is you have unintended consequences. You know, you might be working on something and you figure out something else. And, you know, one of my best inventions of all, which hasn't seen the light of day yet, except in the military sector as a grant recipient, is a portable desalinator to convert salt water to fresh water. And I've been thinking about this for 30 years and it works. I use a double bag. The outer bag has a Gore-Tex, which is, you know what Gore-Tex is, the raincoat. It lets air in and out. It's tiny Teflon, so small that the air goes through, but not the water drops. So I use it in an opposite way. I have a black bag on the inside and a clear bag on the outside with the Gore-Tex. When you put salt water in the sun, it evaporates. The water vapor goes through the holes, but the salt gets stuck and you can sip pure water. But I've never been able to make enough water. So I'm looking at little weird things and going, oh my God. So I bought a towel recently, these self-drying towels. And it's a bunch, like it's like a raised checkerboard. It's all surface area. And I've been visualizing how to build this for years, because water, if you don't restrict it, it'll bulge up. And if it's got the surface tension, it won't evaporate quickly. But anyway, so I'm thinking about this thing, and that's like I get inspiration from a towel. I mean, it's just totally left field, but that's kind of where it is. And the other thing is I never let things go. I put them away, but they're back on the hard disk somewhere. And sometimes something will jog your memory, but you have to be relaxed and open to it and almost not even thinking about it sometimes.
Yeah, in my experience, even trying to help somebody else, whether it's open up and share information or accept an idea, putting them at ease is right. It could be 9/10 of the battle. Like helping,
I agree.
The more pressure somebody feels, you talked about the more tense, the more afraid, their brain shuts down.
So right.
I imagine that works. Like you're talking about, even for ourselves.
Right, internally, it's the same thing.
So you've talked about changing the subject, changing the conversation, walking away, looking for, you know, random motivation or inspiration. If somebody listening to this conversation is like, all right, I want to be a better problem solver. I know everybody's different and every situation is different. But if somebody's thinking, I want to be a better problem solver, where would you encourage them to start in order to change their problem-solving process and mentality to be more successful?
First of all, turn off all your devices. Second of all, get a piece of paper and a pen. Remember those? And you write things, you draw things. Right, exactly. And you just, I think you have to, the thing I do is, I call it flash inventing. Because of all these survival books I read, this guy's going to die if he can't figure out how to catch his fish that's right below his life raft. And he has like a day to do it. I say, I'll give myself a half hour and this piece of paper, and it's like my life depends on it. Think of all these solutions. And even if they're stupid, write them down, think about them, make a drawing. It's just more of a, encourage people to force themselves to solve problems like their life depends on it, and get in the process of writing things down and drawing things, sketching things. And I'm a horrible artist in that sense of sketches. My sketches, people laugh at. But they're, you know, they're stick figure things, but they trigger in my mind what I was thinking about. So that's one way. The other thing is, again, biomimicry. I would absolutely look for an example in nature. How does an animal protect himself when a 30-foot wave is coming after you? Oh, a turtle. He pulls himself into his shell and he's able to go 10 feet down and hold his breath for a few seconds and come back up before another 30-foot wave is. Guess what? I do that every day to train for big wave surfing. I become like a turtle. So when a 30-foot wave's coming at me, I relax and I swim down 10 feet, let the wave go over me, come back up. So animals have adapted and they're much less socially constructed where they worry about what people think about each other. They're totally survival mode. So look to the natural world, go to the pen and paper, force yourself to try quickly to invent things and just see what happens. And again, you can have 100 failures, but if you have one great idea, and that's what I tell people. That's why I don't tell, a lot of ideas are so wacky. I don't want people to think I'm crazy. So I never even tell people. But the good ones will stay and survive with you. And that's how I knew the streamer was a good invention. It never left. Over years, I knew it was a great idea. And even though people laughed at me, even in the military, the Coast Guard, get out of here with this piece of plastic. You know, it's too simple. Hey, that to me is saying it's great. If it's too simple, if it's too simple and solves a problem, no moving parts, that's what I want.
Yeah, I'd say you're onto something there.
All right.
I could try, and Mark Cuban said it, so I guess I'm ripping off Mark Cuban here. I could talk to you all night long, man, but
thank you.
You've got a schedule. I want to be respectful of it. I've really enjoyed this conversation. You've talked about the books that you've written. Obviously, you've got your rescue streamer. For the people that are watching, you can see the pictures behind you. Where should people go to connect with you, to learn from you, to follow you?
Thank you. I appreciate that. Like Amazon, Sea Rescue Streamer, if they want that, or my name, Rob Yalnover. I've got Hardcore Inventing, Caregiver Survival Guide, Hardcore Health, and Brainstorm Islands, the children's book. Those are my four books. And just online, social media, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube, just my name. My name's unique, so there aren't many Yalnovers, so that's an easy way to find me. And I look forward to it. Drop me a line.
I promise I will put all of those links in the show notes.
Thank you.
In Hawaii. I'm in North Carolina. So you're starting your day. I'm wrapping mine up. I'm way getting home. But this was a great way to end the day, man. Super conversation. Lots of energy. I appreciate everything that you shared. It's been a pleasure meeting you, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. I look forward to keeping in touch.
Absolutely. Take care.
Rob, thank you for an awesome conversation. I really appreciate you sharing parts of your personal story. Certainly your approach to inventing, problem solving, collaborating, even just the ability to calm our own minds, the time you spend outside in nature, the impact that has on you. Something maybe is, I guess, simple, but not easy. If you're getting stuck solving one problem, go do something else. Let it come back to you. Some of the random places we can find inspiration. I really appreciate you sharing all of that. I loved how you talked about, especially coming from somebody with your pedigree, show me so I can understand. I think that's very important for anybody who's trying to teach somebody else. The importance of matching people's language, again, speaking on their level so we can maximize our connection and understanding. The importance of remaining observant and curious at all times. Sometimes it's those random observations or things we learn that pay off down the road for us. I really appreciate all that you shared today. Thank you so very much. And of course, thank you to everybody that took an hour to listen to the conversation. I really appreciate you being here every week. Thank you so very much. Please, while you're here, take a quick moment. Like the show, share the show, leave your feedback with us. We'd love to hear from you. What would you like to hear more or less of? Subscribe to the show. We appreciate it. Thank you. And when you have some time, check out our sponsors. Head over to humantel.com and enter the code INCLUSIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class online training. As you start developing the skill set necessary to identify what people are likely thinking and feeling by recognizing changes in their emotions through their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. For the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's so you can get all your questions answered about the International Association of Interviewers. What's in it for you? How can you add to the organization? You can also get all your questions answered on the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. Who qualifies? How do you earn it? What does it mean for your career moving forward? And then finally, please check out inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to custom facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, HR teams, and more, as we teach them how to connect with people in a way that encourages them to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences. We appreciate you being here week after week. Thank you so very much. Please stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time.